And Marie couldn't be with us in the studio this week, so she's chosen a repeat program.
Senior Focus.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Anne-Marie Currie. I'm your presenter for Senior Focus for this session. And it's a warm welcome, particularly as it's the height of summer, but it's warm in another sense about the temperature, and that's the fire energy that's about in terms of the way in which things are happening in the Māori world at the moment. And in particular, there is that extraordinary exhibition of contemporary Māori art, which is not only inside the gallery, the Auckland Art Gallery, but it's spilling out into the surrounding area of Britomart. So you will actually, if you're down near the station at all, you're catching a ferry to Waiheke, program a little bit of extra time to wander out the back of Britomart into Takutai Square, where you'll see the flags, Charlotte Graham's flags. You'll also see on the side of the building in Commerce Street large paintings of urns in the Greek tradition, with a lot of Māori motifs on. And these actually stem back from the early days of meeting houses. so you're going to find a lot of interest. And if you go through the building structure of Takutai at the back of the square, you will find explanations about the artists and their work and their vision and the way they're interpreting Māori cultural concepts. Shane Cotton, for example, and various other people that you may have seen in other contexts and other galleries and so on, but you will not have seen them on in street environments necessarily. This is all part and parcel of understanding, I guess, where New Zealand's headed with regarding its obligations under the treaty, and as a society, this comes under the spotlight once a year when we have Waitangi Day and we have the politicians visiting at Waitangi, and that usually starts off in the Māori world with their visit to Ratana and out just outside of Martin, and the Prime Minister and entourage. It's traditional for them to visit there. Some kaupapa, some discussion in a formal way can be expressed on the marae there. It's not so much political in the sense of the way Parliament's political, but it's very political in the sense of Māori are very direct in a lot of ways, and they're also very symbolic in the way they communicate on the marae on such occasions. So there's a lot of messaging going back and forth. And the opposition MPs often come, whichever party is in power, often opposition parties come as well. So there's quite a mix and a mingling going on over the meals and over the manaaki that occurs following the actual formal marae-based speech-making. Now, I'm actually keen this year to have more people coming in the studio and to have panels, but getting the right people in on this particular topic proved rather difficult. As many Māori I know currently are involved in travelling either to their own marae for celebrations or to Waitangi, and they're deeply embedded in the politics of the moment, as it were. So it's not necessary also very politic for them to be broadcasting on air, because it might look like they're staging some comeuppance against some other preferred speakers from their own people and so on, because you're never just there by yourself. You're actually always representing everybody from the ancestors through to the current day speakers and forum leaders. So you don't have the chance to blow your head off the way people do on talkback radio. That's just not part of the discipline, I guess, of being a member of such a society. So we always have to keep that in mind when we're thinking about planning and talking to people around this time. It's not easy. My experiences with the treaty are very deep and hard for me to put into a half-hour program slot. But when I thought about this particular session, I go back to the early 70s when I arrived in Wellington expressly to learn te reo as a 20-something-year-old because I'd never had the opportunity as a child, and because colonisation occurred differently in the South Island, Māori intermarried, and that's why there's so many white-looking Māori in the South Island. But seriously, the whole culture went underground to the extent that the opportunities to learn to speak just weren't there. There weren't any reo classes at all in those days. And Canterbury University didn't even have a Māori studies department then. But Victoria did. And I sort of got my marae skills and walking legs in the Māori world through Dr. Mitch, whose books Talking Past Each Other and other titles are well known. And I was able to get an insight into what it was like for Pākehā entering the Māori world and what it was also like for second language Māori learners. And Dr. Rangi Nicholson was about in the Polynesian Society. There were Dr. Rangi Nui Walker, and there were a number of people really beginning to talk up the Māori Renaissance that was beginning to happen about the language. Māori radio wasn't in flight then, but it was coming. And so it was a key city to live in terms of the connectivity between a lot of leaders actually forging change. And Dr. Hare Williams, who got the first license to broadcast in te reo, was one of the people that really influenced me back in the day when the radio for Māori got going. So through these experiences and through being around these people, and I was just thinking also of Dr. Mason Jury, or Professor Mason Jury, who's been in the honours this year. He was beginning to look at devolution of funding for health to get Māori health clinics established on Marae as treaty initiative. So going back to the actual treaty document, where partnership and protection of partnership, working and sharing governance. So that meant sharing funding. So that was just the beginning of change in the 70s, which led to, of course, Acts of Parliament that reflected this understanding. And indeed, when the state decided to sell off the state assets, we had the SOE Act in 87, 10 years later. And that was a seminal change because we had Justice Cook in the High Court ruling that SOEs were not to be sold without Māori involvement in the governance, either of the new structure to replace what was going, or in the way assets were devolved, or, you know, there were various classes and clauses, but definitely the treaty assumed legal status and frameworks within governance through the changes that came in with that act. So that was a time of huge celebration for Māori, and I remember people dancing in the streets, like in Molesworth Street, and there was a lot of a release of tension that had built up as people felt, wow, at least something is registering, that this document is alive and there are justice issues that haven't been to the fore that are now coming to the fore, and we can actually start to work from this document more actively in terms of what we can expect in terms of shared governance. And then, of course, came in the protection, and of course, protection of te reo. And so that's where the push for a slice of the airwaves came in. I think Huirangi Waikiripuru, Dr. Huirangi Waikiripuru, who passed away last year and who has not been fully acknowledged because of the COVID situation, we have yet to have a full acknowledgement of his contribution and his passing, and I think this, you know, this will be tremendous when it happens. But he took on the government in the courts in order to ensure that Māori got a slice of the airwaves, and that's how we've got Māori television and 2 Degrees. So that was another example of the treaty in action, justice being delivered, and the growth of a huge amount of Māori digital art has come through the opening up of those channels. And so that takes me right back full circle to this contemporary Māori art exhibition. And the reason why I focused on it to start with was in going and visiting it and going through the various rooms and experiencing the power of the art, and at the same time reflecting through the text on the number of artists that I knew well, the number whose work I had seen in other contexts. But it's not all old art. You know, there's so much new material, and the digital stuff's really exciting. So for me, it was very much a deja vu, because I remembered the first ever Māori exhibition that became an international exhibition and travelled to Chicago and actually was on display overseas for a year, and it was also on display at Te Papa for a year as well. And the way in which it simply brought weight to the whole significance of what Māori were doing in the art world, what they were achieving, what was being produced, and what was already in existence and being looked after, and also the bringing out of much of the work from closets, whether they be Māori closets, because families had kept them, in some cases quite hidden because they were not at all sure if they were going to be safe and if they were going to be respected adequately. And then also from Pākehā closets, because some had been retrieved after they'd left the country and been gifted overseas, either by government or they'd been sold by galleries. Some of these pieces had been retrieved, and it was time to actually acknowledge them and celebrate them. And so there were very significant works that carried huge spiritual energy, which people wrote about, people could actually experience. They could sense the power in some of these works, like the burial chests. So walking around the exhibition, I remembered at one time looking in one direction and then stepping back. And although nothing physically touched me, I was aware I'd transgressed, I'd gone over a line. I turned, and yes, there was a marking on the floor, and I felt that tapu-ness of those chests and the fact that, you know, we had to keep your distance. There were all kinds of tales galore about the power of these objects, and I won't go into that too much because that's really the subject of a different program. But anybody who went to that exhibition was deeply moved. I don't know anybody who went who never felt anything. So it was a very powerful time to reflect on just what can be conveyed about a culture through art. And if you do nothing else in terms of Waitangi Day, do make an effort to go and see the Contemporary Māori exhibition that's currently on at Auckland Art Gallery, because you will find plenty to challenge your ideas about what you think the culture's about, plenty to challenge your ideas about what you think partnership and protection under the treaty's about, and a lot to satisfy you on quite a deep level, because very rewarding. I think it's hard to put into words, but you won't go home feeling bored. I can pretty much assure you of that. Now, we're going to take a music break now, because I want to come back and talk about some other issues relating to this Waitangi time. And I've chosen the Flying Kiwi Shuffle, the Waitara Shuffle as it's known, by TK Jr. And we'll listen to that, and I'll be back shortly. Welcome back, everyone. So today our focus is on Te Tiriti o Waitangi, the Treaty of Waitangi. And sometimes I do hear some strident Pākehā voices saying, oh, you know, we could just do away with it, and we don't need it, and we could get on without it. But there's some significance to the treaty which needs to be really understood in its wider context, and that is that Indigenous people around the globe have had the support of United Nations in terms of their quest to be recognised for their care of the planet, for their connection to the planet, their love of Mother Earth, and their reflection of that in their culture and their values and in their art. And so currently our Māori Treaty is acknowledged as a having power within the legal system of the framework of justice in the world. So the legal courts in Hague and The Hague actually recognise the treaty. And you might say, wow, there's two versions, so which version do they recognise and so on. Well, the Māori version is the one that holds the weight, and that's simply because that's what the people signed on, that's what they believed. They believed what they understood in their own language, not necessarily what was said to them in English, which some of them wouldn't have understood anyway. So they signed on the Māori version primarily, and that is the version that stands up in the court of law. And that's just the legal framework and the basis for it. So it's not just a matter of saying, oh, New Zealand can put it in the rubbish tin, because we don't really have that option as a country. That would look absolutely peculiar, and it wouldn't stand up, and we also would end up ultimately with some form of civil war or civil disobedience on that scale, because that's what happens in countries that don't have treaties, that don't have a valid partnership document, that don't work out a formula for living and working together. And certainly if you investigate the history going back, the country was already settled, and the flag that Māori flew on ships was a flag of nationhood in 1835, long before the treaty was signed. So that is the proof of a sovereign nation, that they travel the world, they use their own flag when they're trading and when they're at sea, and other nations respect that. And so it's like a no-brainer. There's every avenue you could explore, it's already closed off, because we're already on a journey of living and working together, and that document sealed that journey. It wasn't its beginning, but it certainly was its roadmap for the future. In terms of the actual structures, what we're working at on the ground, I guess health was the area in which the biggest change came first, and that was very much based in Wellington, where the Ministry of Health was busy working through the ramifications of actively involving itself in the treaty. And the iwi involved in the area, Ngāti Toa and Ngāti Raukawa and Wellington Tents, they were all very on their marae, hosting a lot of marae discussion around devolution. National hui were held at Porirua on the Ngāti Toa marae. And so this is where the beginnings of the real active stuff on the ground happened within health. And then it spread out from there. I think Auckland is kind of 30 years down the track actually having a renaissance of its own around Te Reo, because the language classes are full everywhere you go, and people are commentators on and broadcasters are mentioning this on other radio, and there's an air about of positivity about learning Te Reo that I haven't heard in the Pākehā world in many, many years at all. I can remember a mild version of it in Wellington 30 years ago, and I can remember some of the stirrings and beginnings, but I can also remember some of the sharp tension and the difficulties some people felt even using Māori in a public space. I remember two women who spoke Māori in a dairy to each other and were refused service by the owner, and that was a case that went to the Human Rights Commission. I remember Dr. Kerry Carr was very loath to speak Māori in the street in Wellington, and we revolutionary types, a little bit younger, were very tempted to do just that on purpose. So in lifts, we'd often talk to each other in Te Reo. I don't think a lot of people knew what language we were speaking, but that was, you know, a way to be a rebel at that time. Now, today, we actually see a number of businesses calling themselves moi this or who this, or, you know, these words, shoe, sleep, whatever, are being incorporated into business names. And it's quite interesting because that was a vision that we had back in the early 90s, and a number of us talked about possible names and even designs that would incorporate Māori motifs. And so now we can actually see this kind of flourishing going on, a lot of new Māori business opening up, and Pākehā people wanting to also incorporate Māori things into their own businesses, and some joint businesses between Māori and Pākehā. So this is a whole new flourishing of the culture. And so the contemporary exhibition has come at a very welcome time, in a time where we've got 25 MPs in the Parliament who are Māori, at a time when their leadership in terms of change, in terms of social issues, in terms of government funding and decision-making and policy is all on the table for discussion. It's all not a huge sea change as yet, but it's all a rich environment in which their leadership is very powerful. So we can expect some interesting commentary around Waitangi post the actual day, and I'm looking forward to seeing how magazines like North and South actually do it, because they often have in the past done very well. So it's an exciting year. It's a year we will have Māori voices involved in the program, and it's a year where we'll have lots of threads from this conversation to pick up as we go along. So I thank you for listening, and I also encourage you to just get out and get amongst the flavour of things, because I think there's a lot happening downtown in Auckland. It's a bit of a nightmare to get through Kay Road at the moment, and not everybody's satisfied with the square at the bottom of Queen Street. But get beyond that, get into Takatai Square at the back of Britomart, and be prepared to be quite surprised at what you see there, and get along to Auckland Art Galleries and enjoy the exhibition. And it's on till May, so you've got plenty of time to go back. It's so huge, it'll be hard to do in one visit. You need to go two or three times. So thanks for listening, everyone, and I'll look forward to being with you in future programs.
Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6 or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus. And do note, Senior Focus is one word.
The Community Connection, planetaudio.org.nz.